let me also add that one reason the Eno stuff was so intriguing for my work was because I'm really interested in the historical ways people have understood music and rhetoric. And I find that when you look at kind of this European history, you know, going back to the 15, 1600s of people applying what they knew about rhetoric then to musical composition, I feel like the results always feel unsatisfactory to me as a rhetorical scholar. There's always kind of this overly simplistic application of a rhetorical term to music. And it always seems like, now I use this figure of rhetoric, so therefore it was rhetoric, and therefore that's what rhetoric is. It's just applying figures and understanding the figures. Ha ha, we're done. And so I've been in search for a while now of what, how do I put into words, you know this, what the complex contemporary ways we understand rhetoric, right?
Sure.
So I think that when I read Rickert, especially in these chapters 3 and 4, where he starts bringing up Eno, I start thinking, this is it. There's something here about reminding us that persuasion is still part of rhetoric, but it's bigger. It's intensified, like we mentioned earlier. Rickert says we have to include more than just what these old theories thought. Mm. And that helps me a lot. It's really, really intriguing.
I'm going to take us on another tangent. So one of the concepts that I think is really interesting about that Rickert brings up over and over again is this reliance that traditional rhetoric has had on this notion of symbolicity. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about, again, that's this idea of these producers, Steve Albini and Butch Vig, and the ways that their job is to produce kind of almost like a symbolic reflection of what the band sounds like. You get this idea of what, for example, the Smashing Pumpkins sound like live.
Yeah.
Billy Corgan's voice is banshee-like. There's a certain affect that you get, you know, kind of get accustomed to seeing them live. That almost completely disappears, especially on the kind of famous Butch Vig production, Siamese Dream, where you get this very clean, very melodic. Siamese Dream is kind of known for its overproduction.
Yeah, I remember being on Smashing Pumpkins' listserv in the mid-90s, and one of the questions going around was, what color do you associate with each album? You know, because that's what we talked about then. And I remember the prevailing answer with Siamese Dream was silver. It was metallic. It's been overproduced to that level of perfection.
Right.
And by the way, it's my favorite album of ever.
Wow. It's up there for me too. Really, it really is. That disparity between the production quality, you know, album and then seeing them live. Even like they've been putting out, you know, these albums again, and one of the things that they often will come with are these, like, you know, extensive alternative takes and that kind of thing. And what you start to realize is that a certain song, say Today by Smashing Pumpkins, to take a well-known example, has achieved a certain iconic symbolic status in our minds that even slight differences in, you know, that experience are jarring, right?
Yeah.
And there's something, I think that there's something interesting there related to the ways that symbolicity as rhetoric kind of ends up maybe blocking or hiding some of what's actually present, what's kind of behind the production curtain.